We welcome Rabbi Rami Shapiro as our speaker today. Rabbi Rami was ordained as a Reform rabbi in 1981, and he earned a doctorate in religious studies in 1985. You can listen to his podcast, Essential Conversations, at spiritualityandhealth.com. Many of you read his column called Roadside Assistance for the Spiritual Traveler that he writes for Spirituality and Health magazine. Rabbi Rami has written more than 30 books. Recent titles include Accidental Grace and Perennial Wisdom for the Spiritually Independent. Today, Rabbi Rami will speak on the topic, The Jew as Novelty, Teaching Judaism in Poland. Let's welcome Rabbi Rami.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For those who are new to this fellowship, let me explain how this goes. I have about 20, 25 minutes to put some ideas on the table, and then we come back after a brief break and we try to make sense out of what I said in a more conversational setting than just standing up here and talking at you. And normally that serves me well, because it allows me to explore ideas without actually coming to some set conclusion. And that is all the more true this time. I have just come back from Poland. It's just a couple of weeks ago, where I was teaching for a week and having interviews with some of the leading figures reclaiming Jewish culture in Poland. And I have not yet figured out what I experienced. So this is really open-ended, and I'm trying to just sort of work this out with you. And if it was just a Jewish talk, then it would be irrelevant. I mean, most of you aren't Jewish, and you know, those of you who are haven't been for a long time and really observe that. So I'm not picking on anybody, Carol. So it was good. But, you know, okay. But I don't think it's just Jewish. I mean, this is a much larger topic, and the topic is, what happens to a people after we've destroyed them and yet can't get them out of our mind? So keep that in the back of your mind and we'll go through this. So a year or so ago, one of my books, it's called Rabbi Rami's Guide to God. It's a very small book. Rabbi Rami's Guide to God was, the rights were purchased by a publishing company in Poland, and they made a Polish translation. And the book was published just in the last month. And they thought it would be a good idea to have the author come and give a series of lectures around Poland, trying to sell books. Luckily for them, I don't speak Polish. So they got to have a translator come and give the talk they wanted, as opposed to whatever it was I was saying. But in addition to the talks I gave, I led a retreat at a 18th century monastery, so a monastery from the 1700s, in a little town in Poland called Kielce. And what makes Kielce so interesting is that in 1946, after World War II, the Nazis were finished, the Soviets were in control, were nominally in control, but not yet firmly in control. In 1946, Jews who survived the Holocaust, who didn't die in the death camps, and who were from Kielce, started to come home. And they intended to reestablish their lives there. But in their absence, the people there, people of Kielce, had already taken over all of their homes, all of their properties, all of their businesses. There was nothing left for them. And if they were allowed to come back and stay, people who had appropriated their stuff would have to give it back. So they came up with this novel idea called a pogrom. And they started killing the Jews. And they started a real classic way. One of their little kids was missing. And Jews had kidnapped him, killed him, and used his blood to make matzah for Passover. Now, that's a teaching that's been part of the Christian tradition for centuries. It wasn't anything new. But after the Holocaust, people were using it less and less, but not in Poland. They still, brought that idea up and riled everybody up And so they had this pogrom. They killed another 46, or I think it was 46 people, were killed in the pogrom before the killers finally exhausted themselves. The Soviets just watched. This was a purely Polish thing. But they never admitted doing it. So they covered it up. And it wasn't until the last few years when the publisher that was publishing my book in Polish decided he was going to make a documentary about it. And he brought out this documentary. I watched the documentary. It's got English subtitles. And you can see the difficulty the Polish people had in dealing with their own history. And they were confronted with some Jews who had lived through this. And sometimes they welcomed them, and sometimes they just shut their doors and said, I don't want to know about you. I don't want to know about this history, even though all of them were old enough to have lived through it. It was a deliberate blindness to what had happened. That was in 1946. Then this documentary a few years ago. In Poland today, what I discovered was there's this concerted effort to whitewash the Poles from any responsibility to the killing of 6 million Jews. So they don't talk about Polish death camps. They talk about only Nazi death camps. They don't talk about Polish anti-Semitism. They talk about Nazi anti-Semitism and Soviet anti-Semitism. They have a museum of Polish Jewish history. And Jews have lived in Poland for 1,000 years. They have this history, and it gives you the entire 1,000-year panorama, and there's only one time when it's really nasty, and that's during the Nazi period. Everything else, there's some kind of struggles back and forth, and it's not a big deal. Everyone really gets along, and it's sort of a kumbaya thing, when in fact, it never was that. But that's the story they tell themselves because they can't deal with their own shadow side. Now, if you've heard me before, you know I think everyone has a shadow side. Every culture has a shadow side. I'm not blaming Poland for anything in particular. Everyone could be a Nazi. Right? I think given the right circumstances, we could all do what the Nazis did, and we would do it with the same sense of self-righteousness in which they did it. We would make some massive excuse. And you see that with the Syrian refugees, the way they're being treated. And it's going to be worse when we have climate refugees. Because we don't want people coming in and taking our stuff, right? And breathing our air and drinking our water. And so we will come up with some excuse to put them in camps and who knows what else. And we did it with the Japanese, right? We did it during World War II. So I'm not blaming the Poles. I'm just there. So I'm just going to use them as an example. The year before being in Poland, I was in Prague in the Czech Republic, and the same thing was happening. There was an inability to deal with their own shadow side. So you walk through the Jewish quarter in the city of Prague, which is an amazing city. I love Prague. And the Jewish quarter is fascinating. And like the Jewish quarter in Warsaw, where I spend a lot of time, the one thing it doesn't have is Jews, because they killed them all. But in the Jewish quarter of Warsaw, I went on several tours, not officially, because I was supposed to be working, but I slipped in. I went to one in English, one in Hebrew, one in French. And I just wanted to hear what the stories were that they told. So just to give you an example of Prague, I'm going to go back to Poland. In Prague, there's this wonderful old cemetery. And it's pretty much intact. The one in Warsaw is not so well preserved. But the one in Prague was really intact. And it goes back centuries and centuries and centuries. And the graves are tightly packed and then stacked together, one on top of each other. And I forgot which tour guide it was, but one of them said, pointing out this fact that the graveyard was so small and the people were so tightly packed, and she said, this shows how close the Jewish community was. That even in death, they like to live close together. They're such a close-knit community. I mean, the fact is, they were locked into a ghetto, and you just couldn't build a larger graveyard, so they had to stack them. But it wasn't because Jews liked that kind of closeness. It's ridiculous. But that's what they told themselves. In Prague, there is the legend of the golem. The golem was one of the figures that inspired Mary Shelley to write Frankenstein when she wrote Frankenstein. The golem is this monster that Rabbi Lowe of Prague built to protect the Jewish ghetto from a pogrom of the Christian community that was about to happen. And what you do is you get clay, you do this prayer over it, and you build this gigantic monster body, and you say the prayers, and you write the word truth on his forehead, and he becomes conscious. And then he defends the community. In the Jewish version of the story, there's all kinds of silly things that you see versions of in the Sorcerer's Apprentice in the Disney movie with Mickey and the brooms coming alive and the water drowning. He's supposed to get a little bit of water. I guess he keeps getting too much. Same thing happens in the golem stories that the Jews tell, because the golem is not the brightest monster on the planet, right? But he's built to defend the Jews, and when the pogrom happens, he does that. He defeats the invading, Christian peasants, and when they run away, he's still programmed to kill, so he turns on the Jews themselves. He doesn't really care who he kills, he just has to keep killing. And Rabbi Lowe, who created him, manages to get on top of his head and erases the word truth by removing the first letter and the first letter of without the first letter of the word truth in Hebrew, you end up with the word met, which means dead, and then he dies. But Rabbi Lowe then takes him apart, puts him in a coffin, and they take him to the top of what's called the Alt New Shul, which means the Old New Synagogue, which is centuries and centuries old. This story comes from the 1600s. And the coffin is supposedly up in the attic of that synagogue. And you can visit the synagogue, you can go up and down, but you can't go to the attic because that's where the monster is. And you have to be, you can't go. And so this woman's telling the story, and she said Hitler wanted the monster during World War II. So Hitler sent stormtroopers to go up in the attic and bring the monster back down so they could reanimate him and send him out against the Allies. But every time the Nazis went into the attic, it's like the Roach Motel, right? Nazis go in, but they don't come out. So the idea was the golem is up there and he's killing Nazis. So they tell only the Nazi story. They never tell you why they made the golem in the first place to defend themselves against other Czech people living in Prague. The same thing was going on in Poland. If you go to Warsaw, and the ghetto there is devastated. I said Warsaw, but I meant Krakow. The Warsaw ghetto, Jewish ghetto, is the whole city was leveled by the Nazis. So there's nothing there. There's memorials and museums. But if you go to Krakow, that's what I should have said. I went to Krakow, spent a few days in Krakow, in the Krakow Jewish ghetto, Jewish quarter, they call it. And there's a Jewish community center. There are six synagogues. There is a Jewish cultural center and a slew of Jewish restaurants. But no Jews. No Jews running the cultural center. No Jews running the Jewish community center. No Jews running the synagogues. Synagogues don't really function. No Jews running the restaurants. They are all Christian Catholics. I mean, it's Krakow, Poland. They're all Catholic people who realize that you can make a good living imitating Jewish life for tourists. And that's what they did. So you go to these Jewish restaurants and they advertise Jewish caviar, which I think was chopped liver. When you try to read the ingredients, it's just chopped liver. They call it Jewish caviar, Jewish fish, Jewish this. And supposedly people, how it's intriguing and how ethnic, and let's go with Jewish fish. And then the restaurants have Jewish music, klezmer music, which is a certain kind of music from that part of the world that still exists in other parts of the world. But I went to a couple of concerts in these restaurants just to see what it was like. And it was imitative. You could tell they were trying, but none of them were Jewish. So it wasn't coming from the inside, it was coming from the sheet music they were playing. And it had and this could have been my imagination, but it had a hollow ring to it. It just didn't sound authentic. But they were doing the best they could. And then the coolest thing, in a very sad way, in both Prague and Krakow, when you go to the restaurants or you go through the Jewish quarter, go through the cemetery, you come out the other end, there's all these little shops that sell Jews made out of wood. to little carvings of Jewish people, almost always men. In fact, it may have been exclusively men, but I can't hold it. Maybe not. But Jewish men, and they're always the Hasidic men, right? So they have the big fur hats, and they have the long side curls and the big beards, and they're wearing their prayer shawls on the outside, and they're carrying a Torah scroll, or they're playing music, and all the things that they remember Jews doing before they killed them, they put them in the carvings, and then they sell them to the tourists. And I bought one. Because I had to say, like, this is what's left. The same thing happens, now I don't know, some of you will remember this, some of you won't, when we had those environmental, save the environment commercials with the Native American character and the tear running down his cheek when he sees the horror of what the white European culture has done to nature. And so we show a Native American, because if there's anything more, there's nothing more earthy than a Native American. But the fact is, you know, we wiped them out as best we could. Right? We really made a concerted effort, especially, you know, it was our Tennessee president, Andrew Jackson, who sent them on the Trail of Tears. And, you know, we're going to replace his face on the front of the $20 bill with Rosa Parks, right? Which makes no sense to me. Harriet Tubman also makes no sense to me. It should be a Native American. That would make sense to me. And
yeah, that actor was Italian.
Was he
American?
In that commercial. Oh, in that commercial. Of course. Who could find an Indian? Why do you need one? I mean, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. That's how it works, right? So the same thing happens in all these cultures. When you have this horrendous ethnic cleansing, and then somehow you need that group of people for your own romanticizing of your own past. And I went and interviewed all these people, none of whom were Jewish. They were all running the Jewish community things. And they were doing this out of pure altruism. The PhDs in Jewish history in Poland are all the rage, but there are no Jews getting them because there's no Jews. But people want, and I would ask the students who were getting their PhDs, why are you doing this? They said, because it's a 1,000-year block of Polish history, and if we lose the Jewish history in Poland, we lose this whole segment of our own history. So I'm doing it to reclaim Polish history. And the same thing I was told at the Jewish Community Center. They said, we're trying to provide, however many Jews there are, we're trying to provide them with a place to be Jewish because it's part of who we are as Poles. They used to be a major part here. And it was the same argument everywhere I went. What I got out of it was this, I mean, the technical term is icky feeling. Right? Just something didn't feel right. But it wasn't exactly wrong either. I met a number of people, but this one woman in particular who works at the Jewish Community Center, who started working at the Jewish Community Center as a Catholic, and then discovered when her grandmother was dying, that she was Jewish. A lot of Jews simply deny the fact that they're Jewish in order not to get in trouble still living in Poland. So they raise their kids as Catholic, and they raise their grandchildren as Catholic. Then on their deathbeds, they tell them, we're really Jewish. And this young woman working at the JCC, it freaked her out completely. And she wanted to convert, and the rabbi who comes twice a month, spends 2 months, 2 weeks out of every month in Krakow, comes from Israel. He said, no, you don't have to convert. If your grandmother was Jewish, your mother was Jewish, and therefore you're Jewish. So there's no conversion. Do you want to learn more about it? She said, I don't know. She was afraid to discover who she might have been. I don't even know how to put it in English. Who she was, but wasn't living as that. You know what I'm saying? A lot of confusion in her life. But she's working at the JCC, and that's how she's connected. And she said, maybe later I'll learn more as I just work here. So there's this real ambivalence, not only among the Poles, but among the Jews who are. Then I did something which I had absolutely no interest in doing. I went to Auschwitz. It wasn't a choice. When I was staying in Prague, teaching in Prague, I had an opportunity to go to Auschwitz, and I said no. I said, I can't see the point of it. When I was in Poland, you didn't have a choice. You're going to Auschwitz. You're going, which didn't sound good. You have no choice. You're going to Auschwitz. No, but I even tweeted I emailed somebody. I said, when I was leaving Auschwitz, I drove there by car, but I left by train. I said, this time the Jew is going in the right direction. I'm not taking a train from Warsaw to Auschwitz. I'm taking a train from Auschwitz to Warsaw. Much better. But they didn't give me an option. And you have to go. And then you have to meet with these people who are running interfaith centers, mostly Jewish, Christian, Islamic, interfaith dialogue centers in the town of Auschwitz, very close to the death camps of Auschwitz. And I sat with these people, and they were wonderful people. They were Catholic priests. They were wonderful people. And I kept saying, why are we doing this? Why are you doing this? And they said, we've got to admit that which we are afraid to admit, that we did this, that the Holocaust could not have happened without Catholicism, and actually Lutheranism. Luther was a huge anti-Semite. But without Christianity, there would have been anti-Semitism, but you couldn't have the Holocaust because Hitler didn't have enough people to pull it off. He needed, and I can't remember the author's name, but the book is called Hitler's Willing Executioners, and it's about Polish Jewry, and he said, they needed people who were already primed to hate the Jews to enlist to eliminate the Jews. So they said, it's our responsibility as Catholics to try to turn this around. And they were very interesting people. And I spent the most time with this one priest. He was from Germany, living though in Auschwitz, and running one of these centers. And he took me around. After I left Auschwitz, he said, you have to go to Bergen-Belsen, I think it's the next camp. And you have to go there. I said, why do I have to go there? He said, you can't come to Poland and not go there. I said, all right, so go there. But tell me, when we get there, which is just 10 minutes from Auschwitz, we get there, tell me why, what am I supposed to get from this? You know, you walk through the Auschwitz Museum, and I walked through with the director, and there's a wall like this, almost this long, and it's glass wall, and it's, I don't know, 6-8 feet deep. And it's filled with Jewish hair. Because when people came, they shaved their heads, either when they were alive or when they were dead, and then they sold the hair. It was a moneymaker for Hitler, and this is just stuff they hadn't had a chance to sell yet. Then they have other exhibits where you see eyeglasses, thousands and thousands, like millions of pairs of eyeglasses. And they try to focus in on, you know, have you focus in on one pair of eyeglasses and realize this belonged to one person who was killed. And they go through all these different things. And it's obviously moving, and it's well done. They're not trying to horrify you. They're simply laying, here's the hair, here are the shoes, here are the glasses, here's the different things. And it does its job in you. But I kept saying, okay, yeah, I'm horrified. So what? What am I supposed to get here that's more than just a sense of horror? And this guy was in his 30s. He was getting his PhD in Jewish history. He was Catholic. And he said, look, we want a change of consciousness so that this cannot happen again. And I said, well, you're wasting your time. This is always happening again. I mean, Jews will say, never again, you know, with the death camps. Never again. All we mean is never again with us, because we have the bomb, right, in Israel. We are now a nuclear power, and so never again with us. But, you know, Somalis and Rwandans, oh, you know, who cares? Croatia, you know. I mean, it's happening all the time. It's happening in Syria. It's happening in Palestine. It's happening everywhere. And you can send as many people as you want through Auschwitz. It's still going to be happening. And he said, well, there's got to be a way to change human nature. And I said, no, there isn't. All you can do is own up to the fact that humans are intrinsically violent, that we are innately capable of doing horrendous things, and that our religion is absolutely no defense against it. There may be no defense against it. We are easily manipulated into doing horrible things when we're frightened enough to think that that's the only way. So I was just left with this empty feeling. Then I had the guy who was taking me around, the priest who took me to Bergamo. He wanted to talk theology, which is my favorite thing. Love to talk. And he wanted to know, you know, how we Jews, you know, still hold on to our faith in God. I said, what are you talking about? I said, most Jews, and I was actually wrong, I'll tell you the statistic. I said, most Jews have given up on this God. Turns out in Israel, was the case. It's no longer the case. 70% of Israeli Jews say they believe in God. Not in the United States. So something's happening over there that isn't happening over there. But I said, I certainly can't believe in the God that you, the priest, believe in. Just, but you have this covenant. You Jews have this covenant with God. I said, if there was a God who actually makes a contract with the Jews, that God broke it. It's over. So if that God exists, fine, I want nothing to do with it. And it's a him. But if that God exists, I want nothing to do with it. The God of history, the God, and this is the standard Jewish view until after the Holocaust, didn't hit us till the 60s. But into the 1960s, the standard Jewish theology was that God operates in history. God's primary concern is the Jewish people. And God manipulates history to either reward the Jews or to punish the Jews, depending on what the Jews are doing. And therefore, the Holocaust, and I heard this from priests, the Holocaust, not unlike the destruction of the temple in 586 BCE or the destruction of the temple by Rome in 70 CE, not unlike any of those things, is simply God's way of getting the Jews to be better. And Jews have told me, oh, and to get Israel. That was the cost of getting the state of Israel. The theology is called Holocaust and Redemption theology. We have to pay the price of getting our own state was the murder of 6 million Jews. And I said, you know, I don't believe a word of that. First of all, any God who wants to trade a sliver of land in the Middle East for 6 million lives, that's not a trade I want to make. That's not the deal I want to make. That God is perverse. That God is evil. But here was a guy who just, how can you say that? Because it was his God. And the more we talked, the more I realized that he needed the Jew to continue to believe in order to maintain his own belief. He needed the Jews to continue to believe that we were God's chosen people so that he could continue to believe that Jesus, coming out of that chosen people, was the next phase in God's using of history. He desperately needed Jews, but not Jews like me. He needed believing Jews. He needed Orthodox Jews. He needed Jews who had the exact same theology as he did, except when it comes to Jesus. And I couldn't provide that for him. The longer we talked, and it was a couple of hours, the longer we talked, the more sad he got. Not frustrated, but sad. Because I was sucking some energy out of his heart because I just couldn't validate his theology. So I'm going to end with this proposition. And then if you're interested, you come back and we'll flesh it out some more. That Freud said, and I don't think this is true, but this is Freud in his understanding of Judaism. He said that Judaism starts when the Jews murdered their leader named Moses. And then they felt so bad about it that they elevated him to this great prophetic status and created an entire religion around him to blot out the fact that he killed him. I'm not saying that's true. I mean, that's just his psychoanalytic theory. But just taking that as my starting point, it seemed to me that the Czechs and the Poles, and I'm sure others, have taken this people that they've decimated, turned them into props, and used them in a romanticized theology in order to build on them their own religious edifice. And that if the Jew refuses to carry that obligation, they're afraid the whole thing is going to collapse. And if they don't have any Jews left to do it, then they're going to hire Christians to dress up as Jews and pretend, because That's what we need to do after we've wiped out a people and try to deny the fact that it happened. So I realize this is rough. It's sort of out there. Again, I'm still trying to make sense out of it. I've got all these notes about what Hitler said and different things, and I realize we don't really need that, but I'll have them if you need them. So if you're interested in trying to explore this whole dynamic of evil, I guess, come back and we'll talk about it some more. Maybe you can help me understand what the hell it was that I went to. Thank you.